Christ,
we made it back. Welcome to a brand new series of Slap the Chicken, the cockroach in the post-apocalyptic wasteland that all of our lives have become. I hope everyone listening likes the new studio which I'm joining you from. It's really cosy. We've got settees, tea and coffee making facilities, a novelty neon sign, framed needlepoint art of Sigmund Freud, everything someone listening in could want. The usual nonsense should be right around the corner with some dodgy musicianship and floundering attempts at narrative world building to match. Let's get stuck into it. Oh, before we do. Before each episode, there will be a quiz on the Instagram stories of the Slap the Chicken Instagram, which you follow, right? Oh, man. Follow it. If you have Instagram, of course, I'm not forcing you to. The answers are within this episode and on the quiz. So if you found the answers from the quiz and you are intrigued, then all shall be revealed. So let's start easy for the new term with a nice harmless subject. Pigments and paint. Just a relaxing little bit of painting time for all of us. Now, if you want to follow along at home, you can get a canvas out if you'd like. Let's get creative. The first paint to go on our canvas contains the first synthetic dye to ever be produced. This is mauvine, named after the Latin name of the mallow flower, which is a similar colour. This fetching shade of purple came about when an 18-year-old boy attempted to make quinine from coal tar, making a black sludge instead. This sludge was washed off to reveal a purple dye. The boy's name was William Henry Perkin, and he made this mistake right when purple was a very fashionable colour for a well-dressed lady. So he ended up dropping out of school to mass-produce the dye. Before this, to make purple dye, you had to boil thousands of Murex snails harvested from the sea. This complicated process meant that Tyrian purple, as the dye was called, was the expensive colour of royalty and priests, before synthetic dye allowed anyone to buy purple garments. We're going to use this to make some nice grass at the bottom. The happy little clouds are going to be made with the warm white tones of white lead. It was a key component of Venetian ceruse, a nasty foundation which was used by the wealthy between the 15th and 18th centuries to achieve a pure white complexion. It also helped them to achieve lead poisoning, kidney failure, skin discoloration, hair loss, and death. You'd still probably get a beauty influencer recommending it now. Johannes Vermeer also used white lead paint to lighten colours and, surprise, surprise, paint white things. He was really good, so if I use it here, it's going to be just as good. The way the white lead would have been produced for Vermeer's paint is by rolling up strips of lead, putting them in ceramic jars filled with strong vinegar, burying the jars in a big pile of manure, and letting the heat from the manure power the chemical reaction in the jars. The white lead formed as a scum on the surface of the lead strips. We then scrape off the scum and purify it for use as a pigment. Disclaimer, this wasn't how I made my paint. The large pile of manure outside the studio is a gift from a listener. For the sky, we have a little bit of variety. Arsenic was used to make various pigments for wallpaper in the Victorian era. It was used for blues and yellows and greens, and poison for any mice that might be around the house. It was also used for pesticides, fabric dye, a cancer treatment, an agent to make glass clearer, and food colouring. Scheele's green was a common arsenic pigment that used not only for wallpaper but for clothing, children's toys, sweets, and pretty flowers to put in your hair. At the time, the newspapers also relished a good story about the women who took advantage of arsenic's relative lack of taste to murder their stupid husbands. It's clear that everyone knew full well what arsenic did to someone, so why on earth did they use it as a food pigment? The answer is capitalism. Why do you think tobacco went unregulated for so long? People were doubtful about what green wallpaper could actually do to someone. One of these people was wallpaper designer William Morris, whose pattern The Strawberry Thief you may have seen on just about anything. We've got it on our address book. Don't see why you wouldn't want to remove the arsenic from your products, not unless you also owned a massive arsenic mine in Devon, for instance. Oh, wait. William! Shall we open a window? The painting's nearly done now, it just needs some sunflowers on it. This little baby in the palette here is uranium yellow, a pigment used for everything from pot glaze to glass dye. The glass glows a ghostly green colour under ultraviolet light and was popular until just after the Second World War. It fell out of favour not because it's particularly radioactive, but because the US military decided all the uranium needed dropping on Hiroshima. And that's the painting done! I think I need a glass of water or something. Well, I'd say that section stayed fairly under control. Continuing with the gentle theme, two animals who share a rather unique ability when it comes to their colour. That's right, my little pogchamps. For the first time in history, we have secured interviews with a cuttlefish and a chameleon. Come on down to the interview area. Since they appear to be running late, I may as well fill you in with some facts about them. Although both animals can change their colour, they have different reasons for doing so. Cuttlefish change colour to match their surroundings with great precision, even in the dark. Chameleons change colour to communicate with chameleon friends and to regulate their body temperature. The darker the chameleon, the more heat it will absorb, and that's on albedo effect. But how do they do it? I wish we could ask them. Cuttlefish have organs called chromatophores, which have bands of muscle over pigmented cells. The muscle bands act a bit like a blind, able to conceal or reveal varying amounts of whatever colour the cell underneath it is. Cuttlefish have these cells in red, yellow, brown or black. Chameleons also have these organs. The transparent skin of a chameleon has three layers of different types of chromatophores beneath it. The bottom layer is brown, the top layer is blue, and the middle layer between them contains both red and yellow pigments. By telling these organs how much of each respective colour they need to show, a chameleon's skin can work a bit like an RGB colour system, varying the amounts of the four component colours it has available to get a massive variety of hues. A further contribution to this hue range is a nanoscale crystal lattice found in the blue layer of cells. A chameleon can adjust the spacing between these crystals to affect how light reflects off them, changing the colour displayed. Whilst we wait for the chameleon and the cuttlefish to appear, let's talk a bit more about why they change colour. Chameleons have a variety of colourways and patterns that they can use to communicate their intentions. Most forest-dwelling chameleons are naturally green or brown. like cuttlefish, chameleons are very high up on the easy lunch scale, so natural selection will force them to be the same colour as their habitat. Darker colours mean that they are stressed, fearful, or ill. A male queuing up to deliver a chameleon knuckle sandwich will quickly flash a series of bright colours. His opponent will either run the fade or fade to a miserable shade of beige, indicating that he is a small, weak boy. Bright, snazzy colours will also be used by males to try and attract women. In the event of some man approaching her like this, a female may change to a specific shade of beige, which means, I do not want to have sex with you. The gap where a joke should be is left as an exercise for the listener.
Did someone say the sex word in here?
Investigate.
FBI, open up!
Well, although the FBI are now here, it seems the chameleon and cuttlefish that we actually wanted have not shown up. Oh, you have arrived. Where have you... What? You were in the green room the entire time? And how about you? You too? Is that why you're both green? How are my staff supposed to find you if you both turn green in the green room? You're pathetic! Here's the check, I've had enough. Ugh. I thought doing an episode about colour would be sunshine and rainbows, but I've been poisoned, irradiated, and worst of all, stood up! That's it. We can save this with some rainbows. Above all our heads, there are millions of little water droplets. As proven by the hot Isaac Newton, light is made up of different colours. These colours can be seen if you pass visible light through a denser material than air, such as water or a hot Isaac Newton prism. The change in speed causes the ray of light to split into the spectrum of colours. This is because certain colours of light get bent more than others when it enters the droplet. Careful now. If the droplets are large enough, light can reflect off the inside of the droplet and put the colours into the order we're familiar with. The order changes because the shorter wavelengths of light, such as violet, have a sharper angle of reflection. Rainbows appear just after it has rained, because this is when the droplets are large enough for this to happen. If British people were real, they would know this. The higher the sun is in the sky, the closer the arc of the rainbow is to the horizon. If you were wondering why rainbows were circular, it's because of the angle of reflection of light within the raindrop. 42 degrees if you were interested. Douglas Adams was right. Of course, it doesn't have to be the sun. If you get any source of light and some transparent medium which is denser than air, a rainbow will appear. One source of light you could use is the moon. When it's low in the sky and unusually bright, there's a moonbow. When there's droplets that fall and sky dark as a pool, there's a moonbow. When it's crescent, it's unpleasant. Do you know why? 'Cause you can't see the moonbow.
Get off!
Disclaimer. Slap the Chicken takes no responsibility for ear damage. None. You sometimes get double rainbows when the light is reflected twice within the rainbow droplets. The second rainbow has colours in the opposite order to the primary rainbow. The dark gap between the two is called Alexander's Band, named after Alexander of Aphrodisias, a Greek scholar who wrote commentaries on Aristotle's work. What about rainbows on other planets? Well, unless there's some sort of liquid in the atmosphere, that's not going to be an option. This rules out a lot of planets, but it doesn't rule out Titan, one of Saturn's moons, which has a methane atmosphere. Methane has a lower refractive index than water, meaning that the angle the light comes out of the methane droplet is wider, meaning the rainbow gets wider. We haven't seen rainbows on Titan, but we have seen a rainbow on Venus. Well, kind of. Venus's atmosphere is made out of dilute sulfuric acid, meaning that rainbow-like phenomena can appear. The phenomenon observed on Venus is called a glory, a series of concentric rainbow rings seen when you are between the sun and the droplets. They are also visible on Earth, but you won't have seen them, unless you have a plane, or you are a big bird. By observing the variation in brightness of the rings, researchers associated with the European Space Agency worked out the atmosphere had another component apart from the dilute sulfuric acid. This component absorbed ultraviolet light. This component's probably a sulfur compound, but the jury may still be out. If everything was known in science, there'd be a lot of people on the dole. How lovely. Want to find out how you can see some glories for yourself? Well, you're in luck, because next episode we'll be taking to the skies with the science of flight. We are clear for takeoff. See you then. Disclaimer. Be yourself, unless you can be a unicorn. You're so old, she's texting me in cuneiform.